weekend.
Today is Friday, August 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. At least 12 U.S. service members were killed by an Islamic State attack at Kabul's international airport.
It's a hard day today. As you know, two suicide bombers detonated in the vicinity of the Abbey Gate at Hamad Karzai International Airport and in the vicinity of the Baron Hotel, which is immediately adjacent.
U.S. President Joe Biden vows to hold those responsible accountable.
We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Our coverage begins now. The Pentagon says that at least 13 U.S. service members were killed in a complex attack outside the Kabul airport, where thousands of people have been gathering in an effort to leave the country after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. A Taliban spokesperson condemned the attacks. The commander of the U.S. Central Command, General Frank McKenzie, shared with reporters what happened.
It's a hard day today. As you know, two suicide bombers, assessed to have been ISIS fighters, detonated in the vicinity of the Abbey Gate at Hamad Karzai International Airport and in the vicinity of the Baron Hotel, which is immediately adjacent. The attack on the Abbey Gate was followed by a number of ISIS gunmen who opened fire on civilians and military forces. At this time, we know that 12 U.S. service members have been killed in the attack, and 15 more service members have been injured. A number of Afghan civilians were also killed and injured in the attack. We are treating some of them aboard HKIA. Many other Afghan civilians have been taken out to hospitals in town. We're still working to calculate the total losses. We just don't know what that is right now.
The site intelligence group reports that the Islamic State group claimed responsibility later on Thursday. An Afghan official speaking to the Associated Press said that at least 60 Afghans were also killed and 143 were wounded in that attack. McKenzie also spoke of the ongoing threat that the Islamic State group presents.
The threat from ISIS is extremely real. We've been talking about this for several days. We saw it actually manifest itself here in the last few hours with an actual attack. We believe it is their desire to continue those attacks, and we expect those attacks to continue. And we're doing everything we can to be prepared for those attacks. That includes reaching out to the Taliban, who are actually providing the outer security cordon around the airfield, to make sure they know what we expect them to do to protect us. And we will continue to coordinate with them as they go forward. We're going after ISIS. Yes, if we can find who's associated with this, we will go after them. We've been clear all along that we're going to retain the right to operate against ISIS in Afghanistan. And we are working very hard right now to determine attribution, to determine who is associated with this cowardly attack. And we're prepared to take action against them. 24/7, we are looking for them.
Speaking from the East Room of the White House Thursday evening, U.S. President Joe Biden said those serving in the armed forces of the United States were the backbone of America and the best that the country had to offer.
The situation on the ground is still evolving, and I'm constantly being updated. These American service members who gave their lives, it's an overused word, but it's totally appropriate here, were heroes. Heroes who've been engaged in a dangerous, selfless mission to save the lives of others. They're a part of an airlift, an evacuation effort unlike any seen in history, with more than 100,000 American citizens, American partners, Afghans who helped us, and others taken to safety in the last 11 days. Just in the last 12 hours or so, another 7,000 have gotten out.
He added that America will hold those responsible accountable.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
In addition, the Reuters news agency reports that the United States is taking steps to allow humanitarian work to continue in Afghanistan despite U.S. sanctions on the Taliban. A U.S. Treasury Department official said that President Joe Biden's administration has contacted humanitarian partners in Afghanistan during the recent few days to talk about their continued ability to provide aid. With the Taliban in control of Afghanistan, the European Union is looking to Turkey to bear the brunt of an expected exodus of Afghan refugees heading to Europe. As Dorian Jones explains, Turkey is resisting that call.
Every day, Afghan refugees arrive in Turkey from neighboring Iran. As the Taliban tightens its grip on Afghanistan, fears are growing the number of arrivals could surge. Greece is strengthening and extending its border wall with Turkey to prevent Afghan refugees from entering the European Union from Turkey. The EU is now looking to Ankara to contain any refugee crisis.
The European Union will be looking for from Turkey exactly what it has been looking for from Turkey about the Syrian refugees, definitely since 2015. That means Turkey is the storage place for refugees, or the dumping place for the refugees.
Turkey already has a refugee deal with the EU, hosting nearly 4 million Syrians who fled the civil war in exchange for billions of dollars of aid. European leaders have been discussing the issue of Afghanistan with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Some analysts believe the EU is looking to extend the Syrian refugee deal to include Afghans, with the promise of more money.
It works for the government to an extent, because the government is so cash-strapped that that money is welcome now. But it is coming at a huge political cost. Again, if we go back to the public sentiment, I think you're seeing the public anti-refugee sentiments soaring.
These are Syrian-owned shops that came under attack by an angry mob weeks ago in the suburb of the Turkish capital, Ankara. The main opposition is opposing any new EU refugee deal, saying Europe should share the refugee burden rather than buying its way out of the crisis.
The European Union simply looks at the migration problem as if it could be stopped by, as you have used the word, buying the problem, by paying and by offering some kind of financial assistance to Turkey. First of all, the assistance that is being offered does not match the expenses that Turkey has already made. And secondly, this is not a solution to the migration problem.
Erdogan, aware of polls showing strong public opposition to receiving more refugees, is now ruling out any new EU refugee deal, instead vowing to secure the country's borders. To this end, construction is speeding up on a border wall with Iran, the main transit route for Afghan refugees. For Afghans fleeing Taliban rule, the search for sanctuary is only getting harder. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Hundreds of Afghans living in India are demanding refugee status from the United Nations Refugee Agency, saying that the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan has ended their chances of returning home. Anjana Pasricher visited an ongoing Afghan protest that began earlier this week in the Indian capital.
These slogans by Afghans living in New Delhi have been ringing in the aftermath of the swift Taliban takeover outside the office of UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. India has traditionally given sanctuary to those escaping conflict-ridden Afghanistan. However, many have been living for years as asylum seekers because they have not been recognized as refugees. That denies them access to education or jobs.
UNHCR office do not do anything for our future.
Sahil Zahiri, a medical school graduate, fled to India in 2018 after suffering violence by the Taliban.
I came here because I was getting safety, but I cannot enroll in a postgraduate course or get a job. I've applied to 15 or 20 hospitals, but they have all rejected me, saying I do not have a bank account.
Many of the demonstrators are women, worried about the future of their children. They say they have no hopes of resettlement.
We are not able to go back to Afghanistan. We face many problems. My children can't study. We are not human. My children doesn't have any rights that they study. What should we do?
I don't get work. With the identity card I get as an asylum seeker, I cannot get a job or admission in a good school because I don't have a refugee card.
I have lost all my knowledge. All that I learned is gone.
Their demand for formal refugee status from the United Nations has intensified after the Taliban takeover, which Afghans living outside the country fear has shut out chances of returning home. India has no official refugee policy. These Afghans, though, say they cannot keep living in limbo.
If India does not accept them or let them settle here, then the UN should send them to some other country like Australia and Canada, which are welcoming Afghans.
After the Taliban takeover, India has offered emergency visas for those escaping Afghanistan. These demonstrators say the plight of those who came in the past should also be addressed. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday for the first time since both of the men took office. That meeting has now been postponed to Friday because of the airport bombing in Kabul. Bennett has already met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, as well as Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. At the top of Israel's agenda is making sure that Iran does not become a nuclear power. Linda Gradstein has this look ahead.
Israeli media reports that Naftali Bennett's first visit to Washington since taking office in June is off to a successful start. Among Bennett's goals, analysts said, is to create a personal relationship with U.S. President Joe Biden. Before his meeting Wednesday with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Bennett said he hoped to help the U.S. understand Israel's attitude toward Iran.
I bring from Israel a new spirit, a spirit of folks who sometimes harbor different opinions but work together in cooperation, in goodwill.
Bennett says he knows the U.S. and Israel may not agree completely on the issue of Iran as a nuclear power. Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz warned that Iran could be just 2 months from developing a nuclear bomb.
And this is the same spirit that, you know, I want to bring to our relationship of cooperation, of goodwill, of friendship. We're going to be talking about a bunch of issues, primarily how do we fend off and curtail Iran's pursuit to dominate the region.
The U.S. has been negotiating with Iran over renewing a nuclear deal that former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of in 2018. Israel worries that a renewed deal would pave the way for Iran to legally become a nuclear power. The meeting also comes against the background of the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Colonel Eldad Shavit, a former senior Israeli intelligence official, says an Israeli official briefed journalists on Bennett's meetings, which came with American assurances.
He said that the Americans are not going to abandon the Middle East and the Americans are not going to abandon Israel. And of course, the Americans will be committed to the security of Israel. I think everything is okay. But the issue is how they are going to do it and how the different partners in the Middle East will translate the American policy and what will be the implication on their policy. Iran and Hezbollah and other partners.
Israel also sought to calm the tense situation on the Gaza border between Israel and Hamas by allowing additional goods and materials to enter Gaza and by increasing the number of workers from Gaza allowed into Israel. At a protest Wednesday, Hamas supporters in yellow vests tried to maintain order. Earlier this week, an Israeli soldier was critically wounded at the border, along with a 13-year-old Palestinian boy. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
After facing severe criticism for the slow start to their coronavirus vaccination programs, many European Union member states have seen a surge in inoculations during the past few weeks, with vaccination rates overtaking those of the United States as well as Britain. As Henry Ridgewell reports, strict rules on so-called COVID-19 passports have persuaded many people to take the jab.
A handful of gummy bears and a certificate, the rewards for these children receiving their coronavirus vaccinations in Germany. It is one of several European countries to begin vaccinating children. Many will begin rolling out booster shots for older age groups in the coming weeks. Speaking in July, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen hailed the bloc's vaccination programme.
The catch-up process has been very successful, but we need to keep up the effort.
The European Union purchased vaccines for all member states. At first, it faced criticism for delays in approval and delivery. Now, member states praise its efforts. Spain and Portugal are now in the global top five for percentage of the population fully vaccinated. Carolina Darias is the Spanish health minister. She said the country's success, a success of all of us, has to do firstly with the European Union's advance purchase strategy. The surge in vaccination rates is also being driven by strict national rules. Over a dozen EU states have introduced some form of COVID-19 digital pass, which shows whether you've been vaccinated, received a recent negative test, or have recently recovered from the disease. Those without the pass are unable to enter bars, restaurants, and many public places. Fabian Zulig is chief executive of the European Policy Centre.
Of course, there will always be a certain group in society which is not going to get vaccinated, which is opposed to getting vaccinated. But those who are a bit more reluctant, those who are on the edge, can be pushed in that direction if there are consequences.
France has among the strictest COVID-19 pass rules in Europe. Seine-Saint-Denis, north of Paris, is the poorest region of mainland France and suffered the highest COVID-19 death rate in the country at the start of the year. But the region is now well above the national average for vaccine take-up. The mayor of the town of Le Bourget, Jean-Baptiste Borsali, says the COVID-19 pass is responsible. When the measures were announced by the president, he said, we saw a huge increase in vaccinations. In Italy, too, strict rules requiring a so-called COVID green pass to enter bars and restaurants have prompted a surge in vaccinations.
Assolutamente sì, perché le persone, insomma, che non si vaccinano fanno una scelta.
Rome resident Melissa Rando said, I think it's right to protect those who have been vaccinated so they don't end up locked up again. Not all approve. Thousands took to the streets of Riga, Latvia, this month, protesting against COVID-19 pass rules. There have been similar protests in France, Spain and Italy. Meanwhile, critics say that Europe is falling behind the United States and China in the number of coronavirus vaccine doses donated to poorer countries and has given just a fraction of the 200 million doses pledged by the end of 2021. The World Health Organization has recommended that vaccinations be distributed to less developed nations before third booster shots are given in richer countries. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
COVID-19 restrictions are not just keeping students out of the classroom, but also out of the laboratory. The University of Johannesburg is helping students replicate the experience through virtual reality. Linda Givtash has that story.
Wearing headsets in front of large TV screens, a group of South African students appear to be playing video games, but they actually are deepening their knowledge of science. The virtual reality hub that is part of the University of Johannesburg's Faculty of Education helps students get up close to atoms, cells, and viruses. Mafor Penn is completing her PhD in science and technology education.
Students are learning in a more interactive way, in a more immersive way. It's more engaging in that they are able to visualize microscientific phenomena. They are able to interact with these phenomena. And you can actually repeat that over and over. It's one of the greatest benefits of learning in this way.
Even before the pandemic made South Africa the continent's hotspot, students' laboratory time was limited, but not in the virtual world. The university developed a VR set inspired by Google Cardboard that costs less than $20 and works with any smartphone.
Sakili Macholi is a third-year education student.
I can use what I've been provided with at the comfort of my couch at home. So you can just go to YouTube. You can use your device, your smartphone, if it's compatible with the apps, and then you can actually view cells or whatever science concept that you are studying at that moment.
VR isn't just helping students study STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. It's also gearing up this next generation of teachers to use technology to boost STEM in poor primary and secondary schools. Professor Amresh Ramnarain heads the Department of Science Education at the University of Johannesburg.
Learners who come from a very much impoverished backgrounds, where schools are in disadvantaged communities, where they don't have fully fitted laboratories. And unfortunately, because of those learning experiences that they have in STEM education, it has not inspired learners at school to pursue tertiary studies.
The shortfalls became apparent when pandemic lockdowns sent students home. Schools scrambled to adopt distance learning technology. But as students return to the classroom, educators like Ramnarain say the pandemic's changes to learning will stick around.
The future of learning is actually blended learning or hybrid learning, whereby we are going to blend face-to-face interaction. So students, there will be dedicated sessions whereby students will attend class, but that is going to be blended now with virtual online learning. I do not believe that we're going to go back to as we were.
The University of Johannesburg is working with South Africa's Education Ministry to bring VR devices to public schools. If the program proves successful, it hopes to replicate it across the country and around the continent. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
On Thursday, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris raised human rights issues with Vietnamese leader during a visit aimed at bolstering strategic ties with the country while in Hanoi. Harris said she specifically discussed the release of political dissidents but did not disclose the results. Vietnam has been the target of global criticism for limiting free speech, a free press, and clamping down on those it considers political dissidents. The United States has pledged another $32 million in aid to the victims of Haiti's 7.2 magnitude earthquake. U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Samantha Power said Thursday that the U.S. government had learned from the 2010 Haiti earthquake and said USAID was coordinating closely with the government of Prime Minister Ariel Henry. The August 14th earthquake has killed more than 2,200 people and left hundreds of thousands homeless. The alleged murder by provincial police in the central Thai province of Nakhon Sawam of a drug suspect has outraged the public. The death was by suffocation with a plastic bag while the suspect was in custody and was caught on camera. The public is demanding reform of Thai police, which is notorious for a culture of abuse, impunity, and corruption. A U.S. federal judge imposed financial penalties and other sanctions Wednesday against nine lawyers with ties to former U.S. President Donald Trump after ruling that their lawsuit challenging the 2020 election results in the state of Michigan was a historic and profound abuse of judicial process.
This is Science in a Minute.
University of Arizona, Stony Brook University, and Wake Forest School of Medicine scientists say they may have found an important mechanism that could determine whether a patient with severe COVID-19 will live or die. According to a U of A press release, the researchers found that an enzyme known as SPLA2-2A has similarities to an active enzyme in rattlesnake venom. Past research suggests levels of the enzyme are low in healthy people but can be higher to fight infections such as the SARS coronavirus 2. According to the University of Arizona's Floyd Chilton, senior author of a study detailing the research, at a certain point the enzyme is released into the bloodstream in such high amounts that they destroy a patient's cell membranes, which can lead to multiple organ failure and death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Refugee Agency reports that tens of thousands of people are internally displaced in Yemen's Northern Marib government, and they're living under deplorable and often life-threatening conditions. Lisa Schlein has the details.
Ongoing fighting between Houthi rebels and Yemen government forces for control of the city of Marib is taking an enormous toll on the civilian population. A recent assessment by the UN Refugee Agency finds settlements hosting nearly 190,000 displaced people are overcrowded and lacking basic necessities. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Ketidi says clean water, latrines, electricity, and health facilities are in short supply.
Only 21% of residents are reachable by aid organizations due to the prevailing insecurity, as many people were displaced in the vicinity of active front lines. Women and children constitute 80% of the displaced. With limited shelter options, they are the ones who suffer most from the ensuing overcrowding, lack of privacy, and limited access to basic services, such as toilets and water.
More than 6 years of civil conflict has uprooted about 4 million people from their homes. Marib Governorate hosts around a quarter of this displaced population. Katiti says armed clashes, shelling, and airstrikes in this volatile region have newly displaced nearly 24,000 people this year. She says they have sought safety in urban centers and in the 150 informal settlements. She says these areas are overstretched and cannot offer even scant help to these vulnerable people.
Their shelters are inadequate, and many have been further damaged by recent floods and fire incidents due to open fire cooking. Given the scarce resources, scores of displaced families have been forced to build their own accommodation using old blankets and plastic sheeting.
The UNHCR is calling on the warring parties to grant unimpeded access to the settlements to guarantee the safe delivery of life-saving aid. The United Nations calls Yemen, where some 5 million people are on the verge of famine, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, Hawaii had a thriving native language press through the 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, there's an effort underway to preserve and renew Hawaiian language journalism. Michael Sullivan rounds us out.
Honolulu Civil Beat, a nonprofit online news site, posts a weekly Hawaiian language section for those who understand or are studying the language. While at Honolulu's Bishop Museum, more than 100 newspapers from a once thriving Hawaiian language press are being digitized, preserving publications from the 1830s to the 1940s. It's part of a revival of a language with few remaining native speakers, says one reporter.
There are really no words to this feeling of seeing my story being translated into a language for my people that my people are trying to bring back.
In 1810, the Hawaiian Islands were unified by King Kamehameha I after years of conflict among regional leaders. The nation became literate after American missionaries developed a written language. Their descendants, however, overthrew Hawaii's queen in 1893, suppressing the language. Hawaiian was revived in the 1970s, becoming the state's second official language, along with English. Hawaii's population is mixed.
I am Chamorro, which is the indigenous people of the Mariana Islands. And so I'm very familiar with kind of the history of indigenous languages being erased and the challenges of kind of bringing them back and helping them flourish.
The language is tied to the land, says a teacher.
The Hawaiian language is almost like the DNA code that has in it our systems of knowledge, our belief systems, our history.
It conveys a way of life.
And that's just the idea of, working with the land and working with the resources you have available and respecting those things.
Reporters want to see the section expand.
That's kind of the dream. let's get content coming to us in Hawaiian and then go translate it back.
The revival is part of the story being preserved as a new chapter is written. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.